Good morning. Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. And we're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Vicente Mora, who is the director of the Instituto Cervantes here in New Mexico. Right now, I'd like to welcome the good folks from the nonprofit organization called Results. We're joined by George Gamble, who's the co-leader for Santa Fe Global Results Group, and Kitty Sherlock, who is with the Santa Fe Domestic Results Group. And we're also joined by Dr. Damian Gessler, who's the program lead for the National Center for Genome Resources. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So let's talk, first of all, what is this group called Results? I'd actually never heard of it till you approached me, Kitty, not too long ago. But I guess it's been around for some time.
Yes, about 23 years. I think 23, maybe even older. But it's an organization that was started back in the 80s to be anti-poverty lobbying, basically. Advocacy to change the world as far as poverty. And our goal is to create the political will to change the systems. So what that means is we have little chapters all over the country who write to Congress or write letters to the editor in newspapers or visit congresspeople or set up like forums or summits to focus on issues of poverty.
And so this is something that started 23 years ago. I mean, it's certainly not rescue work. You're not bringing bags of food to people who are hungry. Other organizations do that. Mm-hmm. It's really trying to get at the root of the problem. How do you see the roots of the problem?
Well, first of all, as you're saying, we look at why the babies are being thrown into the river instead of trying to save each one, you know, looking at system change. And one of the reasons I got into this was I could see that at a certain point in my life when I was working over at Turquoise Trail Elementary, that poverty issues are just very pervasive in our culture.
Were you a teacher there?
I was the school librarian there. Uh-huh. And what I could see is that it's almost like we have a system set up to ignore poverty a lot, or to think individually we can protect ourselves from it instead of dealing with it a lot of times, instead of helping people get out of it. So I found this was a really well-organized group that aimed at this particular problem. And one of the ways it's well-organized, we have an office in D.C. It's supported by our volunteer efforts primarily. And this office really keeps tabs on Congress every day because we do see that one of the major vehicles for changing anything is to go to Congress. You know, no matter how poor you are, you can go to talk about funding for different bills. So that's one of the reasons we aim at Congress. Similarly, the state legislature we also work with. And so the organization, I think, first information, we have our up-to-date information on what's going on in Congress, what's up, like even today, what is going on. And the other the good thing about it is that we have training programs. We do a lot of training of people on how to talk with legislators to get them to really come to a joint agreement on a lot of goals.
Now, have you done this yourself? Have you gone to Washington and talked to the New Mexico congressional delegation?
Yes, I have. And I've gone to Washington, and also I've met here in Santa Fe. Face-to-face.
So that's part. And so do you actually train people, for example, in Santa Fe to go to talk to Bingaman or Domenici or Udall?
Yes, we do.
So how do you do that? What do you train people to do?
Well, one of the things is we found out there are some, especially if you don't have a lot of time, which is usually the case, there are some ways you can kind of shortcut to an issue. And there's a thing called the EPIC talk, which is basically just following a format. Used to also be called the
Epic Talk. That sounds like Fidel Castro giving a 9-hour sermon.
Oh, well, no, they're about 3 minutes.
Oh, okay.
And that's really the point
and
of it.
It's called
is
Epic.
To,
hmm.
Yeah, and
no, Engage.
I've forgotten what. Oh, yeah, the first
it's
one
an acronym.
It's an acronym for first, you know, thinking of, well, you know, what could I ask that this person would wake up to or tune into? And so a little quick question, stating what is the problem, giving information on what is going on right now that a person could take action about, and then following up. That's the last part is saying, you know, can I call you next week about, you know, what this is, what you have done about this? Or so it's, that's another thing we found out over time, is that government people usually promise, you know, to do something, but you have to kind of nail them on, well, can I call you back next week and see what happened? And we have found that to be very effective, much more effective actually than promises.
Now, With great respect, the group is called Results. Mm-hmm. 23 years ago, the poverty problem was probably not even as bad as it is now.
Well, depends on your view. I think the global poverty problem, well, you're right, we've our population in the world has really multiplied since then, so the problems have multiplied. But actually, the child death rate, which is one of the measures we look at worldwide, that has gone down significantly. And that's partly due to the lobbying, not only of Results, but a lot of other groups, toward looking at family survival, looking at how can children be immunized early, what do you do if your child has one of many very common diarrhea kind of problems, what about the survival of mothers? Mothers are a key factor in not only the survival of children, but the education of children. They're usually the number one key factor.
It's interesting. I was reading on your website that no nation has ever reduced its population growth without first reducing infant mortality, which is something
yes,
I didn't know.
Uh-huh. Right.
It's a sort of funny thing. You save people and you actually are able to reduce population in overpopulated areas. They can't support themselves.
That's true. It's a ironic kind of like reverse kind of formula. But the more women realize that the investment in their child is what's important, and that they will survive, the more they realize they can live, then they don't have 20. And because otherwise, in most cultures where you have a lot of children still, they are the main support of parents when they're old. There's no, like, social security. And so that's a guiding factor. So even in countries where there is very low literacy, very low encouragement to have family planning, there, as soon as people realize that their children will survive, they start cutting down the numbers of children they
and
have.
And having fewer children.
Uh-huh.
George Campbell, you work on the global Results.
That's correct.
What activities are you engaged in?
Well, excuse me, I'm doing the same kind of lobbying and efforts to get political will of our members of Congress focused on global issues. And the global issues fall into three areas. One, economic opportunity around poverty, particularly we're focusing on microfinance, which is a worldwide effort, strategy to bring very, very poor people into the market economy, to move them from subsistence living to a market economy.
Which probably 10 years ago almost nobody'd ever heard of, and now people are winning Nobel Prizes.
That's correct. That's correct. And that's a major focus of our interest, both globally and, in fact, domestically. So there are microfinance efforts in the United States as well as throughout the world.
So you lobby people to make microfinancing possible, or you actually set up infrastructures of microcredit?
No, we just encourage legislation and appropriations to do that. So, for example, we're currently, for the past 6 months, we've been lobbying to get congressmen to approach the World Bank, which is a major funder throughout the world for development programs, to get the World Bank to put more money into microfinance. Because the World Bank is dealing oftentimes with governments and giving billions of dollars to governments to do large infrastructure projects, but what they're not doing is any grassroots financing of microfinance, which would help the people from the ground level work themselves up. And indeed, Muhammad Yunus in Bangladesh and many other people throughout the world have demonstrated that microfinance is a very effective strategy for improving the lives of very, very poor people.
And likewise, money at the top tends not really to trickle down to the lowest levels.
That's right. That's right.
Results is the organization that nominated Muhammad Yunus for the Nobel Peace
Prize. Is that right? Oh, very interesting.
The second area, other than economic opportunity, the second area is global health. And indeed, that's one of the issues that Damien will talk about in a minute. We have been focused on the precise point that you, Charlotte, made a moment ago regarding the decline in infant mortality having to occur first before there's a population decline. It's all part of what's often referred to as a demographic transition,
right,
which is moving from infectious disease to chronic disease. So that infectious disease is no longer a problem, and they're more chronic disease.
So that once infectious disease is gone, we've got time for arthritis.
That's correct. That's correct.
Diabetes.
That's correct. And of course, they're very different because chronic disease tends not to be a fatal disease. It's a long-term disease. It's not something people die from. Infectious diseases are things that people die from. So global health has been a major focus also of global results, looking at TB, malaria, HIV, AIDS, and in all those cases, promoting U.S. government support for programs around the world, including the UN's Millennium Development Goals.
Now, there's also a piece which is environmental sustainability. What is Results doing in terms of that?
I think it relates to the microcredit, the microfinance, that we're seeing also that in a lot of places, including northern New Mexico, if people have job alternatives, they don't go to just one corporation for a job. For example, for example, north of Taos, they had a mining company for a long time, and that was the major employment component, and when it went under, everybody was unemployed. So one good thing about microfinance and microcredit is people start their own little businesses of all different kinds, you know, so it promotes diversity in employment.
Let's turn to Dr. Damien Gessler. You are with the National Center for Genome Resources and are here with this group right now to talk about tuberculosis. How big of a problem is tuberculosis in the first place in the United States and in the rest of the world?
It's surprisingly large. You know, there's the adage to think globally and act locally. And how do we actually do that? About a third of the world's population has tuberculosis. That's 2 billion people.
A third has
tuberculosis. It's a surprising figure. Now, by has, what we mean is they harbor the bacterium, Mycobacterium tuberculosis.
Right.
Now, for most people, they will become or will stay asymptomatic. But of those 2 billion people that harbor the bacterium, there's about 8 million new cases a year and 1 to 3 million deaths. So TB is not just a disease of the past, it's a disease that is very much with us. To make matters even worse, the bacterium tends to excite, if you will, and become symptomatic in patients that are under immune stress, in particular HIV patients. And so you kind of get a double whammy with HIV and TB. Indeed, tuberculosis is now the world's number one presenting diagnosis for HIV.
Is that right?
People are showing symptoms of tuberculosis and they go into the clinic, and what they find is they have HIV. Now, what about in the U.S.? In the United States, there's maybe 10 to 15 million people who harbor the bacterium, and about 13,000 cases a year. That's 13,000 active cases. Of those cases in the U.S., since 2002, at least half of them are from non-U.S. born citizens entering the country. And so when we survey tuberculosis in the U.S., we are making a non-random survey of the global epidemiology of TB. So that's very quickly, in a nutshell, the global picture. And what we could discuss is a proposal called the National Tuberculosis Archive, which is a way that we can act locally to make a global impact on this disease.
So what is that?
The CDC, a few years ago, started a program called the Universal Genotyping Program, where they are collecting an isolate, that is, some of the bacteria, of every single case of tuberculosis in the United States, upwards of 13,000 cases. And they're taking these bacteria, and they're not getting us the full DNA sequence of the genome, that is, the genetic material, but they are doing something called genotyping, where you get what's called a DNA fingerprint. It's better than nothing, but it's not the highest resolution that we'd like. This is a tremendous advance forward. But what we'd like to do is, instead of just taking those isolates and getting some genetic material and then putting them in some freezer somewhere, why don't you take those isolates and put them in a professional, museum-grade, barcoded archive, like is at the University of New Mexico. The University of New Mexico has the world's second largest specimen archive, over 600,000 specimens. Once you've got what we call the etiologic agents, that is, these are the actual bacteria, the agents causing disease in our community, now go and get full genomic information on them so we can understand the genetic basis, if you will, for multi-drug resistant or antibiotic resistant tuberculosis.
So there are a lot of different strains of TB, and the drug resistant strains, the antibiotic resistant strains, are a lot harder to treat than the other strains of TB.
That's completely correct. You can treat tuberculosis in the developing world for perhaps a few tens, a few $100. In the developed world, it's maybe $8,000 a case.
Why is it so much more here?
Well, it takes upwards of 6 to 18 months to treat an individual with tuberculosis. You have to go through a reasonably thorough drug regime, but it's treatable with standard antibiotics. When you get a multi-drug resistant TB called MDR, it costs approximately $250,000 per patient. And if you have what is called XDR, or extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis, that is essentially untreatable by first-line drugs. So what the proposal for the National Tuberculosis Archive is take those isolates, barcode them, get the full genetic information of them, and then map out what we call the family tree, or the phylogenetics. Tuberculosis has a substantial data collection infrastructure behind it, about 100 years' worth. And so we are also collecting the epidemiological and clinical information on this disease. So in the National Tuberculosis Archive, it is much more than just a repository. It is taking the bacteria and then taking the associated genomic, phylogenetic, that is the family tree, clinical and epidemiological information, integrating that together in a secured web access information resource. So scientists, clinicians, public health decision makers can query questions into it and search on data and run algorithms and programs to better help them make evidence-based decision making. For example, trans-jurisdictional trends, the evolution of antimicrobial resistance, and these type of things.
We're talking to the folks from results.org, and March 24th, which is, I guess, next Monday, there's a tuberculosis summit in Albuquerque.
That's correct. And with the help of Results in organizing this, Dr. David Smidley, the president of UNM, will be speaking. Dr. Alfredo Vigil, the Secretary of Health for New Mexico, will be speaking. Dr. Robert Duncan, the director of the Institute of Advanced Studies at Lana, will be speaking.
Don't people get vaccinated against tuberculosis?
That's true. Unfortunately, the vaccine for TB, which is one of the oldest vaccines in the world, it only really works for children. You lose any protection from the vaccine after about the age of 5 to 7. And even for children, it's not nearly as effective as we would like. There's a lot of work and
so
a lot
I
of
was,
money.
So if I was vaccinated at the age of 5, then I'm still not immune from getting TB now?
You are vulnerable now, that's true.
Uh-huh. So all of this is happening. how can people, for example, with the tuberculosis question, how can individual citizens be effective in this? I mean, is this something where you're also lobbying Congress and so on about the subject of TB?
Yes, we are. Yes.
And what is it that you're trying to get them to do?
We're trying to raise the awareness of TB, and in particular, we are putting forward to them solutions on how we can bring current-day technologies, like we currently have, together in something like a National Tuberculosis Archive to bring evidence-based decision-making infrastructure to nationally and globally important infectious disease.
Kitty, one thing that I wanted to ask you is, and this is something that I've been thinking about and witnessing lately, is the importance of lobbying your congresspeople and letter-writing campaigns. How effective are letter-writing campaigns really? I mean, let's say that there is some subject that the people feel strongly about on the one hand, and then there's like big corporate lobby money on the other side.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm very glad you asked that. I began in results a long time ago in about 1991 with a very cynical perspective that this would not make very much of a dent. But over time, I've changed my mind. And for one example, with global groups, we have now what is called the child survival. There's a child survival component in the foreign aid bill. And that was put there really by results lobbying. And I'm not sure, George, do you know about how much money there is in
No,
that?
I don't.
It's about, I think, $650 million now in that money. And that was basically due to lobbying one congressperson from Ohio, who then went and lobbied a person from Alabama who was in charge of the foreign aid bill. So we basically persuaded one congressperson to go talk to another one. And he became, Callahan was the name of the congressman from Alabama. Excuse me. Anyway, he became the bulldog for just that child survival fund. And that is one of the major reasons, the money that goes into the foreign aid bill for child survival to basically immunize children, immunize mothers, make sure they have clean air and water and basic education, those usual UN components. That funding is one of the major reasons why child mortality has gone down over the last 20 years. So it has been increased every year, this child survival fund, from a very tiny thing 20 years ago. So that, I would say that's one example of where just going and talking with a congressperson really made a very big difference. And letter writing is very similar. And it makes
How does letter writing compare to, say, faxing, emailing, calling? Uh-huh. I mean, there's all these things that people do. And something that I am quite cynical about, which is petition signing.
Yeah.
Especially online petition signing. It seems to me they probably don't care about that at all.
I think they are affected, but it is a good point. There are different degrees of effectiveness. Before 9/11, a handwritten letter was the most effective thing you could do, just totally handwritten, because it meant it was your individual opinion that you were taking the time to write.
What, now they think it's got anthrax in it or something? They don't know.
Yeah. So right now it takes 3 months for a letter to get over there to Congress, so it slows down your effectiveness.
My goodness.
So now people handwrite letters, like for example in our groups, we handwrite letters and then we fax them right away. So they see the handwritten letter, but it's through a faster medium. And then we usually mail the letter also, which will eventually get there, but in time to do any action, they really need to be faxed.
Very interesting. Very good to know.
Yeah.
And but handwritten letters are more effective than, say, phone calls or signing a petition or whatever.
Usually, because very often with petitions and phone calls, a lot of times phone calls are the very last thing we do in a campaign. And, you know, we and other groups will flood the offices of Congress or the state legislature. So basically they have just a little checklist there of yes or no on a bill, and they'll just check it off, yes or no. You know, they won't reply to your comment on a phone call.
Right.
But so it is also effective, but not as effective.
Whereas they will actually read your handwritten fax.
Right. Uh-huh. Someone, an aide, usually will read it.
one of the great strengths of results is the coordinated effort around any particular issue, so that we know, for example, here in Santa Fe, when we are working on supporting additional funding for TB eradication in the world and treatment, we know that there are groups all over the country that are doing the same thing with their congressmen. So in
effect, at the same time.
Exactly, at the same time. So it's a coordinated effort, which is much more effective than the kind of dribble effect that you and I might have if we were not part of a larger group effort. And I think, again, it's one of the great strengths of results.
So anything else you want to say before we go?
Yes, I wanted to just mention in our domestic efforts, we also are aiming at education for all, increased access to education, focusing on the U.S. We worked a great deal on the SCHIP, the State Children's Health Insurance Bill, and other health issues. So we're also behind a domestic TB campaign. And we're also, this year, we're aiming at tax reform, which means having a better tax system for people in poverty to encourage people to. For example, this year, if people do their tax return, a lot of very low-income people don't even do a tax return very much. If they do it, there's an increased earned income tax credit, child tax credit, as well as the rebate, you know, the economic stimulus money. So we're encouraging increased benefits for people to pull themselves out of poverty.
Kitty Sherlock and George Gamble are with Results, and it can be found on the web at results.org. And Dr. Damien Gessler is with the National Center for Genome Resources. Thank you all very much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Charlotte.
We're going to take a little break right now. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like to welcome now, joining us by telephone, Vicente Mora. He is the director of the Instituto Cervantes in Albuquerque. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hello, how are you?
Wonderful to meet you. Tell us about the Instituto Cervantes. This is not only in Albuquerque, it's actually an international organization.
Yes, Instituto Cervantes was founded in 1991 for the Spanish government, and now we are in 70 countries all over the world. Here in the States, we have the three centers, one in Chicago, one in New York, and one in Albuquerque. And now we offer classes too in Santa Fe. The Instituto is dedicated to teaching Spanish and also to spread the Hispano-American culture all over the world. And then here in Albuquerque and Santa Fe, we are specifically trying to recover to the Spanish heritage culture of New Mexico.
Let's talk a little bit about the history of the Spanish language. It's a Romance language, which means it has its roots in Latin of ancient Rome. What was the historical process by which it turned into what we now know as Spanish?
Ooh, that's a very long journey between, it takes 20 centuries, really. First of all, Spain was invaded, as you know, for the Romans. And then when they let us the language, the Latin language, and then the Spanish is a natural development of the Latin and the native cultural languages that they were in Spain. Then it takes, as I said, 20 centuries to achieve the Spanish that we have now. This Spanish are truly very different ways. There's a lot of nouns and shades and ways to speak the Spanish because, you know, in the discovery of America, a lot of different cultures mixed with the Spanish all over America. And then we have now a lot of different ways to speak Spanish. For example, you know, here in the north of the state of New Mexico, we have a very creative and very special way to speak Spanish, mixed with Native American shades, Native American words, and even Mexican, and also, of course, words of English too. Then that mix, for example, is a very richfulness Spanish. We are proud of that kind of direction, that kind of ways of pronounce and live the Spanish language.
Where does the word castellano or Castilian come from?
It's from a region of Spain called Castilla. Castilla was a kingdom. That was founded about the 10th century. And Castilla was like a heart of antical Spain. Castilla was increasing her territories, crossing boundaries, and then the Spain, as we understand it today, is the result of the spreading of Castilla.
So, you're from Spain. You're fairly recently here in New Mexico. Let's talk about Spain for a few minutes. What are some of the other languages spoken in Spain, and how similar are they or different from Spanish?
Okay, in Spain we have a lot of different languages because, as we said before, there was a lot of previous cultures, previous to the Romans, previous to the Visigoths, previous to the Islam people, and today there are three co-official languages in Spain: there's Euskera, Gallego, and Catalan. We offer here in the Instituto Cervantes, we offer classes of those languages too, because it's part of our richfulness as part of the Spanish culture too. Euskera is the most difficult and the most different one because this is speaking only in about 150,000 people in the world. It's a very difficult language to learn and to speak. It takes a lot of time to learn it. Catalan and Gallego are perhaps more similar to Spanish languages. They are very, very nice languages. The sounds very good. They are good languages for literature and poetry and for to sing, for example, because they are a lot musical. They have a lot of music in the way to pronounce. And then now there is a lot of community sense between all the languages in Spain. All of them are protected for the Spanish government. All of them are teached for the Spanish Instituto Cervantes. And for us, for the Spanish, they are a part of our culture too.
We're talking to Vicente Mora, director of the Instituto Cervantes in Albuquerque, here in New Mexico. How closely related is Portuguese to Spanish? Can you, as a Spaniard, understand Portuguese, or do you have to actually learn it and study it?
The Portuguese language is very similar to Gallego because Galicia is in the north west side of Spain, and Portuguese, as you know, is in the west side. And then there was a lot of communication between the two areas. And then Gallego will be in the same. If there is a line, you can imagine a line between the Portuguese and the Spanish, Gallego is in the middle. And then, obviously, I can understand most of the words of the Portuguese, and the Portuguese can also understand very good than a Spanish speaker. For example, we don't need sometimes when the Spanish writers we come to Portugal. This is not usual to translate, for example, the readings or something like that, because the people understand us very well, for example. There are Portuguese is a very rich language too, very antical, you know. They spread the language too in America, in Brazil. The official language is Portuguese, and now too is officially in Brazil Spanish. And there are two antical and rich languages, and it's a very musical language too.
There are also Arabic elements in the Spanish language that don't appear, for example, in Italian. How did this come about?
That's a big truth because, you know, the Islamic people were 8th centuries in some part of Spain. Then, as you can imagine, it led a big heritage. And for example, in my hometown in Cordoba, in Andalusia, the Islamic heritage is anywhere. It's in the buildings, it's in the monuments, it's in the language too. For example, our river Guadalquivir is an Islamic word. For example, a lot of names of rivers, of cities in Spain, or streets in the cities, they take those Arabic names. I think its legacy is also in our literary culture too.
And also in music and dance, no?
Oh yes, for sure. Even in the call to the horses in the south of Spain, for example, they has there's another big legacy, and even in science and in a lot of things. For example, as you said, music is very popular in Spain. The mix between flamenco and Islamic music, there are some explanations about the origin of flamenco. One of them, the most popular one, said to the flamenco has Indian origin, but a lot of people think too that flamenco has an Arabic and Egypt origin too. It's very difficult because it was a very antiquated process, but it's obvious that old Islamic has a big legacy in Spain.
What are the earliest texts that we have in the Spanish language? Are they written, are religious texts, poetic?
Okay. The texts in Spanish, they are, I think that they are less difficult than that usually the people knows about it. Because, for example, writing is, I think it's not very difficult. Perhaps learning the grammar could be a bit hard for an Anglo speaker. But I think, as I can see in the classes of Instituto Cervantes, I think the Anglo people, they learn very, very quickly the Spanish because it's a very logical language for the Latin region. And then, that developed, the recent development of Spanish is relationated with this because Spanish is now a language of dialogue. It's the second language of communication in the world after English. That not means that it will be that Spanish be the second more spoken. For example, Chinese is more practiced. The question is most people in the world use English and Spanish to communicate communicate through. And that's the reason why that explains the development of Spanish, because now in the world there are almost 500 million people who can speak Spanish. And I think that because I try to explain this because I think it's easy to learn to speak Spanish, and that explains this big spread all over the world.
We're talking to Vicente Mora of the Instituto Cervantes. Tell us about Miguel de Cervantes, the author after whom the institute was named.
Okay, Miguel de Cervantes, as you know, he was a world famous writer. He born in Alcalá de Henares, it's a town next to Madrid. Actually, the Instituto Cervantes has his headquarters there in Alcalá de Henares precisely for that reason. Cervantes wrote Quixote, as you know, one of the biggest novels of all times, like, for example, Vladimir Nabokov said. Not only the Quixote, because Cervantes, it was a great dramatic writer. It was a poet, too. Most people don't know it, but he was a very good poet, too. They wrote, a short stories, all exemplar novels that they are amazing. It's a fabulous stories about the time, the people, and the ambient of the Spain in the 16th and 17th century. All the work of Cervantes is like the perfect Spanish for us. It's like the reference it's like image that Spanish writer, how the literature could be understood. I think it's the most important feature of Spanish culture that we ever have.
So a language evolves, as you said, over many centuries, but at a certain point, the language becomes standardized. There's a standard grammar. Yet in the colonies of Spain, mostly in Latin America, there's so much variation. Is there one standard Spanish right now, or are there multiple versions of standard Spanish, depending on what country you're in?
No, sure. There are Spanish as country in the world, because in all the countries that Spain is speaking, from Filipinas to New Mexico, from Spain to Argentina, or even Guinea in Africa, Spanish is spoken to, there are a lot of variation, a lot of shapes, a lot of nuances, a lot of differences between the in the way that the people speak Spanish. For example, I referred before, I was talking about the different use of Spanish in New Mexico, for example, and that's the reason why here in the Instituto Cervantes we offer the both things. We offer a way of a minimum standard Spanish to understand the language in all over the world. That kind of Spanish that we teach here is easily understanding in all the countries of the world that speak Spanish. But also we offer classes of the specific Spanish of New Mexico and the cultural heritage. We have a program with Maria Dolores Gonzalez. She is from UNM. And she has that problem. It's Spanish for heritage speakers, and she's trying to recover the memory, the heritage. He's trying to do a sociolinguistical project and try to involve all the people in New Mexico that they want to recover that languages that verbal Spanish that they hear from their parents. But they grow speaking just in English. Now they are trying to recover this. They are trying to improve their Spanish. Maria Dolores is doing in that direction. Is doing an excellent and great job.
So you have been in Albuquerque for a few months. Have you heard New Mexican Spanish? And I wonder how New Mexican Spanish compares to, for example, Mexican Spanish.
Oh, it's New Mexican is true in the middle between the standard Spanish and the Mexican, because obviously there is a lot of Mexican heritage, cultural heritage here in New Mexico. Most of the Spanish speakers here are Mexicans too. I think the 90% of Spanish speakers in New Mexico they came from Mexico, or their parents came from. And then I think it's very similar. There are most expressions of the Mexican Spanish variation who are used to here in New Mexico. There is a lot of words, for example, in the Cobos dictionary, and even there is another kind of influence. For example, the words that the people words in English. Other people pronounce it in Spanish, like with a Mexican accent. That's another way to influence. There's another possibility to put in relationship the both languages too.
What would be an example of that?
For example, there are literal translations for when the people is speaking in Spanish here. There are literal translation. For example, I'll call you back in Spain. For example, we'll say, te llamo después, o te devuelvo la llamada. Nevertheless, in New Mexico, the people say, te llamo para atrás. For example, it's like using a literary translation. For example, I can't remember now. Because
to which you can answer, no te llamo para adelante.
No te llamo para adelante. For example, there's a word, cliquear, a click in English, when you use the mouse in the PC. And for example, the Spanish people here said cliquear instead of click, for example, or parquear instead of park a car, for example. There is a lot of curious things in the use of Spanish here.
And that's very much a phenomenon of living close to a border. There are people even in for example, Ciudad Juarez, who will say la troca, whereas in a different part of Mexico, they'd say la camioneta for the truck.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's clear, because when I talk with my with all the rest of the directors of the Instituto Cervantes in Spain, the director of New York or the director of Chicago Instituto, they never talk me about that. I think it's just a special issue here in Albuquerque and Santa Fe, obviously for the proximity of the borders. Yeah, that's for sure.
One of the beautiful things about Spanish is the incredible slang and just creativity of language that people have. Especially, I mean, I've visited Cuba, and the Cuban Spanish is so fast and difficult to understand, but it's got so much creativity in it that manifests itself in not only the language, but the music and everything else.
Yeah, that's what I said, that there is an Spanish as for each country. In Hispanic America, for example, because you know, for example, in Cuba there was another cultural heritage, but the local one with you know, the cajun and all the stuff of the primitive and native Cubans, and then that culture, I think, had a great influence in the way that recreate the Spanish language in Cuba, for example. In Cuba, as you said, there is another way, more musical, more rhythmical, to speak the Spanish. I think it's in their blood, because they are, it's a people like a lot of rhythm and a lot of sense of sound. It's very difficult, for example, for the Spanish of Puerto Rico, or the Spanish of Costa Rica, whereas they are countries. And they are very close to Cuba, but they are a lot of different. I think it's in the heart of the Caribbean people, that kind of feeling, the languages, a special way to feel the language. And I think it's very different, for example, the most cold one, if you like, from Chile or from Argentina. They are different, for example, to people of Guatemala or the people of Venezuela. They have a more powerful way to feel the things and explain it, I think.
Now, there's one African country, as you mentioned before, Equatorial Guinea, where Spanish is the native language. How did that happen? It was not a colony of Spain exactly, the way you know, Mexico and Peru and the other countries of Latin America were.
No, yes, it was a Spanish colony, but just for a few years. I'm not sure about the period. But it was only for, I think, not more than 40 or 50 years. But the question is, the Spanish legacy is well important. Even Guinea has a special important for Spanish in the, for example, in the international policy. There is always a special relationship between the governments of Spain and Guinea in that sides. I think the Spain here is very popular, just like the French in other African countries, or even the Holland in South Africa. It's very curious to travel to the north of Africa, through Morocco, Senegal, and Guinea, because you can feel the legacy of a French and Spanish in each country is very different, and you say people that it's very similar. For example, in the race, in the color of the skin, and whatever. But they speak different languages, different second language, and they have different cultures for that reason. And that's a very interesting journey to do.
So we have just less than 1 minute left, but tell us about the programs that people can use to study Spanish and Spanish Hispanic culture in Albuquerque and Santa Fe.
Okay, we have a lot of we have two different ways to courses to offer. We have language Spanish offers in four levels: beginning, intermediate, advanced, and superior. But we have two programs for workshops. We have the program, as I said, of Spanish heritage speakers. We have a special courses of conversation of Mexican literature, and even for the preparation to the DELE, it's a diploma that you can an exam that you can take to get a Spanish diploma like a foreign language. In Santa Fe, we have two. That also special courses of conversation, intermediate conversation, but we have in the Santa Fe Prep, I'm Tom Udalhall, courses of Spanish in from beginning level to superior.
Vicente Mora is the director of the Instituto Cervantes in Albuquerque, and if people would like to call for class information or registration, the number is 505-724-4777. Muchas gracias por estar con nosotros.
Muchas gracias a vosotros, Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear this show and any show of the last year anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team under the direction of the marvelous Bill Dupuis, and after that, the Jazz Experience. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Hasta la vista. Ciao.